Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The killing in Eswatini of prominent human rights lawyer Dlani Maseko has been strongly condemned by UN Rights Chief Volker Turk. Mr. Maseko, who was also a pro-democracy activist, was shot dead in his home in the Southern African Kingdom at the weekend. In a statement calling for accountability, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights urged the Eswatini authorities to ensure a prompt, independent, impartial and effective investigation into the killing. Mr. Turk also insisted that those responsible should be given a fair trial and that all Eswatini people should be protected, including human rights defenders, journalists and political activists. At the time of his killing, Mr. Maseko was the lawyer for two members of parliament facing trial for offences allegedly committed during civil unrest in Eswatini in 2021. In 2015, he was acquitted on appeal and released from a year in detention for allegedly criticising the judicial system, the UN Rights Chief also noted. $2.5 billion, that's how much funding the UN World Health Organization, or WHO, needs this year to help a record number of people facing disease and starvation. In its appeal, launched on Monday, the WHO said that a staggering 339 million people now need humanitarian assistance globally. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the UN agency's Director General, urged donors to be generous and help WHO to save lives, prevent the spread of disease within and across borders, and support communities as they rebuild. The UN agency is already working in an unprecedented number of emergencies, from the fallout of devastating flooding in Pakistan to catastrophic food insecurity across the Sahel and in the Greater Horn of Africa. The WHO is also heavily involved in alleviating suffering in Ukraine following the Russian invasion, and it continues to work in Yemen, Afghanistan, Syria and northern Ethiopia, where conflict, COVID-19 and climate change have dangerously disrupted health systems. To Yemen, where UN workers have unveiled a drinking water network in Marib that will provide some relief to almost 15,000 people affected by the war. According to IOM, the UN migration agency that unveiled the project, thousands of families have lacked adequate access to clean water in the area for years. The Al Suwaida Water Supply Project serves 4 displacement sites in Marib. IOM maintained that it's an example of a durable solution that allows people to access vital and more affordable services and to become less reliant on aid. In the coming months, the UN agency pledged to expand the project into more schools and health facilities in the displacement camps where it was unveiled at the weekend. Across Yemen, more than 15 million people require clean water and sanitation services, nearly 8 years since conflict escalated between the internationally recognized government backed by a Saudi-led military coalition and Houthi opposition forces who occupy the capital, Sana'a. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Yeah, that's right, listeners. It is a cold day, and we're expecting snow. Today, we're going to have our usual lineup coming up, Democracy Now! Top headlines from Amy Goodman and Janine Jackson's Counterspin. Plus, we're going to forestall the musical interlude, and we're going to squeeze in Max Blumenthal and Aaron Maté talking about Why Democracy Now! Sucks from the Gray Zone. So let's get moving. We don't have much time. Second hour, John Grant and I will be discussing a recent article by James Lansden in the letter from South Carolina. Very interesting letter titled, it was printed in the New Yorker magazine, and it was titled The Swamp. And it's deals with some true crime. If you're a true crime fanatic, as I tend to be sometimes, you might enjoy this episode that we're going to discuss. Right now, back to latest headlines, world headlines of Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In California, 7 people were killed and another person critically injured Monday as a gunman opened fire on 2 sites in the coastal community of Half Moon Bay. Police say the suspect, 67-year-old Chun-Li Zhao, turned himself into police after the massacres. Authorities could not confirm whether the semi-automatic weapon he used was obtained legally. A local official says the victims were Chinese and Latinx farm workers at a local mushroom farm where Zhao reportedly worked for decades. Dave Pine is with San Mateo County Board of Supervisors.
But in the end, there are simply too many guns in this country, and there has to be a change. This is not an acceptable way for a modern society to live its, and conduct its affairs.
There have been 3 mass shootings in California in the past 3 days. In Oakland, California, at least 1 person was killed and another 7 injured in a shootout at a gas station just after 6 p.m. on Monday night. It came as police in Des Moines, Iowa, charged an 18-year-old with murder after a shooting at a center that provides education for struggling high school students. 2 students were killed in Monday's assault in Iowa, and a teacher was injured. Meanwhile, the death toll from Saturday night's massacre at a Lunar New Year celebration in Monterey Park, California, has risen to 11 after another victim died in the hospital. Investigators said Monday they recovered 42 bullet casings from the scene of the attack, the Star Ballroom Dance Studio. A 26-year-old man is being credited with thwarting an even larger tragedy after he wrestled the shooter's gun away from him at a second studio. Brandon Say said he confronted the 72-year-old gunman, Hu Khan Tran, after Tran drove to another dance hall and appeared to be loading his semi-automatic assault pistol.
Something came over me. I realized I needed to get the weapon away from him. I needed to take this weapon, disarm him, or else everybody would have died.
Police reportedly took 5 hours to alert the public that the gunman was on the loose Saturday night. Tran was found dead the next day of a self-inflicted gunshot wound in his van. The Los Angeles County Coroner's Office has so far named 4 of his victims, among them 65-year-old Mai Mai Nan, whose family said in a statement Monday, quote, "She spent so many years going to the dance studio in Monterey Park on weekends. It's what she loved to do. But unfairly, Saturday was her last dance," unquote. On Monday, residents of Monterey Park held a candlelight vigil to mourn the victims of Saturday's massacre. Local resident An Lau organized the vigil.
"We never thought that it would be one of us. And it's so shocking. We can't accept it. And the reason we came together is basically I was talking to our friends and I thought we have to do something just to get our emotions out, just to comfort each other, just to tell each other that we can go forward."
In the wake of the shootings, cities including New York and Los Angeles have stepped up security precautions for Lunar New Year celebrations, fearing more violence against Asian American and Pacific Islander communities. After headlines, we'll speak with Dr. Connie Won, co-founder of the AAPI Women Lead Organization, and Nick Saplina of the group Every Town for Gun Safety. A warning to our audience, the following headline contains graphic images and descriptions of police violence. In Tennessee, the parents of a 29-year-old African-American man who died after he was brutally beaten by Memphis police say their son was defenseless during the ordeal. Tyree Nichols died of kidney failure and cardiac arrest on January 10th, 3 days after his violent arrest following a traffic stop. On Monday, Memphis officials privately showed police body cam footage of Nichols' arrest to family and attorneys. They said after viewing the video, Nichols was pepper sprayed, tased, restrained, kicked, and beaten. This is family attorney Antonio Romanucci.
He was defenseless the entire time. He was a human pinata for those police officers. It was an unadulterated, unabashed, nonstop beating of this young boy for 3 minutes.
Oh my God.
That is what we saw in that video.
In the wake of Nichols' death, Memphis police officials fired 5 officers for violating department policies, including use of excessive force, failing to render aid. Like Nichols, all 5 of the former officers are Black. Tyree Nichols was a skilled skateboarder, an amateur photographer, and father to a young son. 4 more members of the far-right group, the Oath Keepers, were convicted of seditious conspiracy Monday for plotting to keep Donald Trump in power after the 2020 election, resulting in the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Last month, a jury also convicted Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes of the same charges. In related news, an Arkansas man who was photographed with his boot on a desk in House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office during the attack on the Capitol was convicted Monday on 8 charges, including obstruction of an official proceeding. Richard Barnett, who was also convicted for carrying a stun gun inside the Capitol, faces up to 47 years in prison. This follows the arrests of 3 active duty Marines who've been charged for taking part in the Capitol insurrection. Mika Coomer, Joshua Abate, and Dodgedale Hellinan were among the mob of Trump supporters attempting to stop the counting of the electoral votes on January 6, 2021. Here in New York, a former senior FBI official was indicted in a federal court in Manhattan Monday after prosecutors accused him of taking hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes and conspiring to get Russian billionaire Oleg Deripaska removed from a U.S. sanctions list. 54-year-old Charles McGonigal pleaded not guilty to the charges, which include money laundering and violating U.S. sanctions. The United States and Israel have launched one of their largest ever joint military exercises in the latest ratcheting up of tensions over Iran's nuclear program. The exercise, codenamed Juniper Oak, involves thousands of soldiers, a dozen naval vessels, and over 140 warplanes, including nuclear-capable bombers. In the occupied West Bank, Palestinian protesters gathered Monday at the site of a Bedouin village after 2 high-profile Israeli lawmakers demanded its demolition to make way for illegal Israeli settlements. This is Aida Halim, a spokesperson for the Bedouin villagers.
The existence of settlements here means fragmentation of the West Bank. This village is the key for peace in the Middle East, or the dream of every Palestinian for the establishment of a state. If this village is taken and gone, and they confiscate the area from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea, the West Bank will be split into West Bank North and South.
On Monday, Human Rights Watch warned in a new report that Israeli guidelines on access to the West Bank for foreigners threaten to further isolate Palestinians from loved ones and global civil society. The group added in a statement, quote, by making it harder for people to spend time in the West Bank, Israel's taking yet another step toward turning the West Bank into another Gaza, where 2 million Palestinians have lived virtually sealed off from the outside world for over 15 years, unquote. In Brazil, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has fired the commander of Brazil's army 2 weeks after the attempted coup and violent attack on government buildings in the capital, Brasilia, by supporters of the far-right former president Jair Bolsonaro. Army General Julio Cesar de Azuja is the highest ranking of dozens of military officers removed by President Lula over their suspected involvement in the January 8th riots. In other news from Brazil, authorities said Monday they've identified a Colombian illegal fish trader and gang leader as the person suspected of orchestrating the murders of British journalist Dom Phillips and Brazilian indigenous advocate Bruno Pereira last June. Ruben Dario da Silva Vilar is already in the custody of Brazilian police. He's accused of running an illegal fishing network near Brazil's borders with Peru and Colombia. And the region where Pereira and Phillips went missing days before their remains were found. Meanwhile, the Brazilian president Lula has accused Jair Bolsonaro's far-right government of committing genocide against the Yanomami people of the Amazon. Lula's remarks came after he visited Yanomami communities as they face a humanitarian and health crisis triggered by illegal mining that polluted rivers and destroyed forests, depriving people of key food sources. Brazil's justice minister said he plans to order a federal investigation into the crimes. The music and audio streaming giant Spotify says it's laying off 6% of its workforce, about 600 workers. Nearly 50,000 employees at U.S.-based tech companies have been laid off so far this year, following nearly 100,000 tech layoffs last year. In California, workers at a Pete's Coffee store in Davis have approved the coffee chain's first union. Pete's Workers United celebrated the victory, tweeting, "We will not be the last." Unquote. Starbucks Workers United, which has unionized hundreds of Starbucks shops across the U.S., said on social media, quote, "Solidarity from coffee shop, welcome to the labor movement." And in Alabama, a worker who helped lead an unsuccessful union organizing drive at Amazon's warehouse in Bessemer says he was abruptly fired without explanation. Darrell Richardson, who led a campaign to organize his coworkers into the retail, wholesale, and department store union, says he was given no reason for the firing, but he believes it was because of his union activity. This comes just days after the National Labor Relations Board threw out Amazon's objections to a union drive at the company's massive Staten Island warehouse known as JFK 8, declaring the Amazon labor union won last April's election. To date, it's the only successful unionization campaign at an Amazon facility. It came as the percentage of U.S. workers who are members of the union fell to a new low in 2022, just over 10% of the working population. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as FAIR has noted year after year, corporate media's annual tributes to Martin Luther King Jr. do a lot of disfiguring and co-opting of his words and his work, which, if you think about it, tells us how powerful and disruptive those words and that work were and still are. The actual Martin Luther King said in 1961, quote, "Call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, but there must be a better distribution of wealth within this country for all God's children," close quote. The Washington Post managed to translate that into a 2017 editorial headlined, quote, "Martin Luther King Jr. was a true conservative," close quote. U.S. media elites have gotten comfortable with what writer Adam Johnson calls their wall calendar version of King, in which he represents the good left, unmoved by racial nationalism and Marxist ideology. With Patrice Lumumba assassinated by the CIA in 1961 as the newly elected leader of the Democratic Republic of Congo, the story is different. Look up Lumumba on the anniversary of his murder, and you'll find, well, nothing, really, except maybe a story about how street vendors in Kinshasa are being pushed off Lumumba Boulevard to prepare for a visit by the Pope. Martin Luther King, corporate media would have it, offers a lesson about hopes and dreams and the slow but steady push toward progress. Lumumba's assassination, judging by media attention, has zero lessons for U.S. citizens or the press corps to learn about the past, the present, or the future. Well, that's how you know you should pay attention. Maurice Carney is the co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo, and he has another story, and we're going to hear about that today. We'll talk with him in a moment, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. A recent guest essay in the New York Times concluded a searing takedown of our technology overlords with the sentence, quote, "We have a technologically driven shift of power to ideological individuals and organizations whose lack of appreciation for moral nuance and good governance puts us all at risk," close quote. So you might think, wow, I didn't know the New York Times had it in it to take on Google, Meta, and Amazon so directly. And as Dorothy Benz writes for Fair.org, you would be right, because the technology overlords in this op-ed are not Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, or Elon Musk. They're the software engineers supporting the open source messaging app Signal. And the piece, headlined "The Signal App and the Danger of Privacy at All Costs" by Reed Blackman, makes the case for corporate and government surveillance. By demonizing freedom from such surveillance as a dangerous plot by unnamed technologists who are developing and deploying applications of their technologies for explicitly ideological reasons. That ideology, it appears, is privacy. Signal's website says, quote, "We believe championing user privacy means keeping your data out of anyone's hands," close quote. For Blackman, writing for The Times, that needs the addendum that, quote, "criminals have also used this government-evading technology," close quote. Well, this fear-mongering is familiar, and it rests on an old authoritarian argument that law-abiding citizens have nothing to hide and therefore nothing to lose from government intrusion. What about the young woman who needs an abortion and needs to make sure her messages are not tracked? What of the BLM activist planning a protest who wants to avoid police sweeping up and tear-gassing demonstrators? What about the transgender teenager looking for support who needs to hide their identity from their parents? They're all potential criminals to Blackman because they're all targeted by various state and federal laws. And opposition to such targeting, quote, "reflects a lack of faith in good governance, which is essential to any well-functioning organization or community seeking to keep its members and society at large safe from bad actors," close quote. Well, that's a very revealing sentence. According to Blackman, the threat to a well-ordered society where people are safe from bad actors comes from a lack of faith in the good intentions of government. But for those outside of ruling circles, the bad actors too often are government actors. As Benz explains, unethical and illegal government surveillance happens all the time, from the massive NSA surveillance programs that Edward Snowden exposed in 2013, to the surveillance of Muslims by the New York Police Department, to the routine surveillance of people planning peaceful protests by the Department of Homeland Security's fusion centers. But Blackman goes a little further. There's something sneaky in all of this, he says, accusing Signal of surreptitiously making its users carry out its rather extreme ideology of privacy. Scaling up its technology is scaling up its ideology, he says. Users are, quote, witting or unwitting advocates of the moral views of the 40 or so people who operate Signal, close quote. Well, why are Signal's politics more sinister or more ideological than Meta's? Does Blackman really believe that Signal users are unknowingly furthering an agenda any more than Google or Amazon users? Well, you won't learn that from Blackman himself, a corporate and government consultant whose specialty is artificial intelligence. As Dorothy Benz notes, if there is a case to be made that routine surveillance of the sort enabling harvesting metadata is compatible with a democratic society, well, this op-ed is not that case. What it is instead is a manipulative, intentionally alarmist attack on the very idea that people have a right to online privacy. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by this radio station and by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Counterspin listeners will have heard a number of tributes to Martin Luther King Jr. this past week, a few searching, many shallow. Importantly, the King holiday usually includes attention to his assassination, as well as to his life and work. Though even the best reports, if we're talking about corporate media, fail to draw the straightest lines between the two. This week also marks the anniversary of another assassination, that of Patrice Lumumba, the first elected prime minister of the post-independence Democratic Republic of the Congo. Elite media appear to find that 1961 murder harder to pave over and easier to just ignore. But thinking about it, learning about it, involves the same sort of challenges to the U.S. role in the world and how racism shapes that role, lessons that we very obviously still need to learn. We're joined now by Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of the group Friends of the Congo. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Maurice Carney.
Thank you. Thank you, Janine. It's my pleasure to be back with you.
Well, I will ask you to begin where we have in the past with a reminder to listeners about January 1961 and the circumstances of Patrice Lumumba's assassination. How was the U.S. involved, but also why was the U.S. involved?
Yes, the United States was directly involved. In fact, Janine, the United States State Department released declassified documents a number of years ago, within the last 7 years or so. And those declassified documents reveal that the operation in the Congo on the part of the United States and its Central Intelligence Agency, a covert operation, was the largest in the world at that time in terms of financing. And the chief of station, Larry Devlin, chief of station of the CIA in the Congo, he wrote a book entitled Chief of Station Congo, and he lays out why that the United States felt that Congo was important and that it remained in the sphere of influence of the United States. Larry Devlin said, in essence, that if we did not overthrow Lumumba, not only would we have lost the Congo, we would have lost all of Africa. So Devlin centered the Congo as a part of U.S. overall foreign policy, strategic policy for the African continent. So the overthrow of Lumumba was vital to the United States. And we say overthrow because in Devlin's book, it's really a playbook that he lays out for how the United States moves against democratically elected leaders who are not necessarily inclined to toe Washington's line. And that was the problem that the United States had with Lumumba, that he was an African nationalist and a Pan-Africanist, one who loved his people, loved the continent, and as Malcolm X stated, he was the greatest African leader to ever walk the African continent. And the reason why Malcolm X said that is because he saw that the U.S. couldn't reach Lumumba in the sense that they couldn't corrupt him. They couldn't entice him to sell out his people for trinkets, just like some of the other Congolese leaders had done. So the Congo was key, and is key for a whole host of reasons that we can share a little later.
Well, and the idea that the CIA chief of station, Larry Devlin, would use the pronoun we might lose Africa.
Yes.
This is so deeply meaningful in terms of policy narrative, and here's where media come in to play their role of serving this narrative. And I know that you've spoken in the past about the role that U.S. news media played in working with the CIA and Larry Devlin and other U.S. foreign policymakers to destabilize Congo and Lumumba. I mean, media storytelling carried a lot of weight here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The narrative is critical. A number of years ago, we talked about Time magazine at the time was portraying Lumumba as a monster, as basically laying the groundwork to justify his liquidation, removal from power. Because we paint this picture of a monster to the global media, when covert action is actually implemented by the Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S. government, then no one, you know, folks are going to say, well, oh, he was a monster anyway. So it doesn't matter if he was democratically elected.
Right.
Doesn't matter if he was a legitimate prime minister. He was a bad guy. And the United States and its media and its people see themselves as the good guys.
Yep.
So if the good guys move in and get rid of the bad guy, then it's fine. And this is really an important point, too, Janine, because that narrative, these people who were involved at the time, some of them are really still alive today.
Yep.
They write books and they make films to paint themselves in a positive light because of their concern of the repercussions of history, when the truth actually comes out in terms of the dastardly role that they played in not only removing a democratically elected leader who was subsequently assassinated, but also imposing a dictatorship over the Congolese people, in essence, destroying any prospects of a peaceful, democratic, prosperous country in the heart of the richest continent on the planet. So recounting the story and correcting the history and continuing to tell the story, especially during the commemoration of Lumumba's assassination, is so vital. It's so critical, and it's not something that is stuck in the past, but it's very, very much relevant for today because the same forces that were at play in the 60s to remove Lumumba are at play today in terms of keeping the Congolese from advancing and fully benefiting from the enormous wealth that's in their country, which is what Lumumba stood for. He made it clear in no uncertain terms that he was going to serve the interests of the Congolese people. He was going to leverage the wealth of the Congo, not only for the benefit of Congo, but for Africa as a whole. This basically scared the Western powers because they thought they were going to lose access to the resources that we've learned over the decades that are just vital to a whole range of industries, not only in the West, but global industries.
Well, this is absolutely a story about this very day today. And it's so important to not think of this as a historical commemoration. But when I looked for coverage, I found pretty much nothing in terms of U.S. media coverage. But I did find, for example, when I was just looking for references to Lumumba, one of the things I found was the Dutch Prime Minister's official apology for that country's role in slavery and in the trading of enslaved people. And I wanted to ask, the role of these official statements about apologies, which is not the same thing as a truth and reconciliation conversation, but these official apologies in the context of a general informational void about the specific actions and attitudes that created the phenomenon that now official people are sad about. And with context to Congo, I just wonder, like, this is the coverage. This is what media cover is,
right?
When a powerful person says, I'm officially sorry. And that's not the kind of coverage we need.
Right. And that's in line with narratives over the past few years, right? Because even this, the summer of 2022, you had the Belgian king who had gone back to Congo. He didn't apologize for the role that Belgium played in basically plundering and destroying the Congo, and he said he regretted. And this apology, regret, it's really important because remember one of the events that shot Lumumba into world attention was this June 30th, 1960 inauguration speech where he laid out in excoriating detail the nature and the scope of the brutality of King Leopold II in the Congo and Belgian colonialism. So this, we're talking about 60 years later where you have the Dutch or the Belgians issuing apologies or regret. It really doesn't carry weight for the masses of Africans. And I say that because if you recall the passing of the Queen of England, and if you look at the coverage, you saw that Africans, you know, writ large, were basically celebrating and recounting in detail the atrocities that the British colonial power carried out, not only in Africa, but certainly in India and in Asia.
Yeah.
So this apology narrative, Janine, it's really an elite affair, and the broadcasting of it is sharing the crocodile tears of elites. But if you consult the masses, if you look at the oppressed masses, the working class, you'll find the type of response that they have, not only to colonialism, but also to neocolonialism and contemporary capitalist and imperialist exploitation of their lands. And you'll find outrage, you'll find anger, and you'll find people teeming to demand change of the power relations that exist currently in the world today.
Well, I know that Friends of the Congo works year-round, but that you also use every January 17th to uplift the life and the murder and the legacy of Patrice Lumumba, as well as that of Joseph Okito and Maurice Mpolo, who also died on that day, right? And I would like you to talk a little bit about the goals of the action that you do every year, because it's not just lamentation. It's about more.
Exactly. Exactly. We commemorate Lumumba to remind the world not only of the imbalance in the power dynamics between the Western world and the global South, but also to remind people of the principles and ideas that Lumumba lived for and ultimately died: self-sufficiency, self-determination, pan-Africanism, internationalism. And those principles obtained to this day, and they've been embraced by young Congolese in particular, young Africans in general, who are carrying out, building on the legacy of Lumumba. So the cry is, Lumumba lives. That is to say, his ideas, his principles. And I was in an exchange with one young Congolese before our commemoration yesterday, and he was sharing that there are 1,000 Lumumbas in the Congo today. So what we try to highlight is the extent to which the current generation has taken up the mantle and is continuing that pursuit for a self-determined, independent Congo that is inextricably linked to the self-determination and independence of the African continent as a whole. So that's why we declare January 17th of each year Lumumba Day. And people go to lumumbaday.org and they sign up to take action, either get a resolution passed commemorating the day. They can sign up to support the youth who are carrying on the tradition of Lumumba. They can be a part of the current movement in the Congo that is very much as critical today as it was during the time of Lumumba. So it's very current, very contemporary, and speaks to the tremendous importance that Congo carries, not only for Africa, but for the world as a whole, being part of the second largest rainforest in the world, and is vital in the fight against the climate crisis, and at the same time, Janine, being the storeholds of strategic minerals such as cobalt,
yes,
which are vital in the pursuit of a renewable energy revolution. So it's at the nexus of critical resources that are vital to the future of the welfare of the planet as a whole.
Well, I just wanted to ask you if you have another minute in you about precisely that, that Congo is not a story of the past. Congo is very much a story of the present. And I wonder if U.S. journalists or journalists listening to this are looking to connect the history and the ongoing history of exploitation to the current exploitation and are looking for stories as inroads to that. Are there particular issues or stories that you would direct, you know, an enterprising U.S. reporter who's looking to get into this? What should they start at?
Oh, my goodness, there are so many. And if you're talking about questions of peace and security, we see the instability unfolding in the Congo as a result of, in large part, U.S. foreign policy and financing and backing proxy leaders in neighboring countries. So peace and security questions. Congo has suffered the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II. It'd be interesting to see a comparative between the response that we have in Ukraine in the media and what we see in the Congo, which the United Nations says is the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II, where an estimated 6 million people have lost their lives. But yet the coverage seems to lack in comparison to how Ukraine is covered.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about the Green New Deal and climate crisis and renewable energy revolution, you have to talk about Congo. There's so many stories that you can address in that kind of pursuit. The minerals, cobalt, critical to renewable energy sector, the Congo Basin, which is the second largest rainforest in the world, and yet it sequesters more carbon than the Amazon itself. It is the largest repository of peatlands, tropical peatlands in the world. It stores enough carbon that can address the carbon emissions of the United States for 20 years. So it's just a tremendous number of stories that can be addressed. And then you have a situation where you have Congolese, 70 million of them living on less than $2 a day, while one billionaire by the name of Dan Gertler, he makes $200,000 a day from royalties from Congo's minerals. So the question of poverty, exploitation, plunder, that can be explored by journalists as well. So there's just a tremendous amount of stories that can be written around the Congo, because its significance, as I stated earlier, is not just for Africa alone, but for the world. And therefore, it demands the world's attention, and it demands in-depth, nuanced treatment, not only of the Congo itself, but of the Congolese people and the enormous courage and dignity that they stand on in confronting the challenges that they face.
We've been speaking with Maurice Carney of Friends of the Congo. Find their work online at friendsofthecongo.org. Maurice Carney, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. Thank you, Janine. It's my pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website. It's FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for our newsletter extra or for our email list. It's also the place to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Well, here we go. Now, we've got something new here. It's from the Gray Zone. And you'll hear Max Blumenthal and Aaron Maté and a comedian, Randy Credico, discuss, and this aired maybe less than a week ago. Well, during the Progressive International Conference in Washington, D.C., about Julian Assange. It was during that period, I think last weekend. And once again, it's Max Blumenthal, Aaron Maté, and comedian Randy Credico in a 12-minute clip talking about why the show Democracy Now! Sucks. They got a point. No big deal here. I still like their headlines. Here we go.
You've been consistent from day one in support of Julian Assange. You host a show called Assange Countdown to Freedom. You've been in touch with Julian. You actually interviewed him on that show
right
early on, right?
And yeah, back in 2017 twice, and then he got locked up. The second time I interviewed him, that's how Assange Countdown to Freedom came into being. It was April 11, 2000. I got to make this point, 2017, because he had done a show that's on WBAI in the morning, but it's also its own show, Democracy Now!, early on April 10th, 2017. And he got ambushed. I mean, totally ambushed by Amy Goodman and who was it? Juan Gonzalez and this character by the name of Alan Nairn.
Alan Nairn, who's a great journalist.
Yes,
a lot of really important stuff. But that interview was an ambush. It was.
Well, you take a look at it, and they haven't apologized for that.
Let's take a look at that, Randy, and then we're going to get your comments.
Yeah.
After we take a look at this, as soon as I'm able to bring it up. Part one.
They need to make a public apology for this. They have to atone for it. They can't just like it didn't happen. It happened.
It happened. Okay. Well, these are some highlights that I pulled right before this live stream because I wanted to discuss this because Amy is moderating the Belmarsh Tribunal despite having done this, and this is just utterly disgusting. But of a part with what democracy has become.
Mitchell, here Democracy Now! DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, in October, The Intercept published a conversation between Glenn Greenwald and Naomi Klein about WikiLeaks' decision to disclose thousands of John Podesta's personal emails. This is part of what Naomi Klein said.
I would add, it's not just that they didn't curate it and just dumped it all, right? They are dumping it. But they are doling out the dumps, right?
They're dumping it and doling it out, right?
Clearly to maximize damage, right? So they're not just saying,
right?
Hey, information wants to be free. Here's everything we have. Journalists have a field day, go through it, right?
Right.
You know, they're very looking for maximum media attention. You can tell that just by looking at the WikiLeaks, Twitter feed, and, timing it right before the debate.
That was Naomi Klein in October, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Your response to some of her remarks?
Well, I think it's a bit rich for Naomi Klein, who's a very wealthy woman sitting up there in Canada, to be accusing a political prisoner who's been detained for the last 7 years without charge in violation of two UN rulings without getting her facts straight.
My view of this is that
this is Alan
during
Nairn.
The campaign, WikiLeaks often suggested that Trump would be less dangerous than Clinton.
No, we didn't.
I think you did.
No, we didn't.
I think that concept is wildly, gruesomely mistaken. There was the argument,
that's fine for you to say that, but you should understand that no, we didn't.
However, I would note that the Trump campaign thought that WikiLeaks was on their side. Now, the idea that Mr. Assange just suggested Clinton were equally dangerous, two different deadly diseases, I think is wildly and gruesomely mistaken.
Wildly and gruesomely. He likes to say wildly and gruesomely.
And, he did not know, because I spoke to him that night, and he asked me to do the show the next day. And he did the show the next day, hence that's how Assange Countdown to Freedom started, he and John Pilger on the next day, and because he was so unsettled by that attack, the three of them, you know, they were supposed to talk about whatever the new revelations were. I think it was Vault 7, but they didn't. They went right. Vault 7 had been released, and they couldn't talk about that. And then three days later, you have Pompeo 4 days later coming out. I guess he felt it was okay since the putative left is attacking Julian Assange. We may as well call him a hostile intelligence force or whatever he called them. So that was a very bad move by them. And I urge the three of them to make a public apology right now because they haven't atoned for it. You just can't act like it didn't happen because it did a lot of damage.
Aaron, wasn't there a component of that interview where they started to challenge Julian Assange on being essentially in league with or colluding with Russia?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was in that interview, but there's definitely one interview where, I don't think Alan Nairn was there for that, but I remember this, where there was, Adam Schiff was spreading all this innuendo about WikiLeaks and Assange colluding with the Trump campaign, and Randy Credico, our guest, being the back channel somehow, right? All this ridiculous stuff. And I remember Democracy Now! Basically parroting that, taking it seriously as if it actually might be true, and repeatedly pressing Julian Assange on it. And at some point he says, I don't have time for this. This is just really stupid. And I'm sorry to, Julian Assange said to Amy on air, he said, I'm sorry to see that you're falling for this. Because
he said that. He says, I can't believe you're buying into this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She says, buying into it, Julian, we've got evidence. I mean, you of course have debunked all of this stuff. I was never back channel. Roger Stone never had a back channel. You've made that clear a million times. You've debunked Russiagate and the whole idea that there was some kind of collusion. And especially it's so ludicrous. Look, I mean, she should say, wait a second. Julian Assange, a journalist, has this hot story, and just a week before he's going to release it, he's going to give it to Roger Stone to have it, and Roger Stone is going to sit on it.
Dumb. But amazingly, Randy, Democracy Now!, this is an example of where I think Democracy Now!'s editorial standards have fallen on some key issues. Not all of them, but on some key issues, and this is a good example. A few years later, in 2019, they brought on, their top guest on Russiagate was Marcy Wheeler, who is just
Kidding me.
She was their top guest on Russiagate, and she's a just unhinged conspiracy theorist.
A nutcase. She's a complete nutcase.
Yeah. Well,
I've had so many conversations with her. She actually believes all of this stuff
does. And so she came on Democracy Now! To make the case that, yes, Roger Stone did have advanced knowledge of WikiLeaks releases, and basically making the case that there was a back channel between Roger Stone, WikiLeaks, and the Trump campaign. And this was aired uncritically on Democracy Now! Of all places. And so now that Julian Assange is being persecuted, they've wised up, and now they're covering his story more. And Amy Goodman's there moderating the Belmarsh Tribunal today. But it's an example of how at times when it mattered, so many people that, progressives have counted on to deliver the news factually and to have a backbone, have some critical thinking skills, have failed. And also at a time when it was so incentivized to sell out Julian Assange, because after 2016, Julian Assange became public enemy number one, even more so than he was before in the eyes of liberals. And accordingly, there's been, there's that mention in that clip of The Intercept. They published all these stories disparaging Julian Assange, taking seriously the idea that he secretly conspired with Russia. And so there's been all these incentives in media to throw Julian under the bus. And Randy, you deserve a lot of credit because you have not jumped onto that bandwagon.
You and Aaron have done incredible work on Syria, and you don't see that. I want to go back to Democracy Now! They don't do balanced work, if you want to call it balanced at all.
They suck.
They suck on Syria. They were not good. They have not been good on the Ukrainian stuff. They always have this one woman on talking about atrocities committed by the Russians, but nothing about what Ukrainians have done I don't know if they did anything about what this foreign minister said who just resigned under Zelensky, if they did anything on that. They certainly
they don't do what they used to cover. So we used to, back when I was there at Democracy Now!, we covered the Maidan coup, we covered the role of the U.S. in placing weapon systems in Poland and Romania, the expansion of NATO, all the provocations. If you go back and watch the old Democracy Now, you'll see better coverage of the current Ukraine war than the current Democracy Now. Because we used to have on people like Stephen F. Cohen before he was banned as a guest on Democracy Now. Oh, yeah.
He was banned from Democracy Now. That is amazing.
I was banned from Democracy Now. John Pilger was banned from Democracy Now. He wrote me a long note about how he was banned because one of their major funders from the Lannan Foundation decided he didn't like him.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah.
Soros is a funder, and I know that the Ford Foundation and these.
I don't know if they're funders.
I don't know who the funders are, but they get big money. They have take a look at that studio. It's as big as MSNBC.
It is. I used to hang out with all the Democracy Now! Crew, and they were like my buddies in New York, and they're like what I look to as real grassroots journalists. And something changed dramatically. Don't have time to go into all of it and speculate. I would just say, they did great work in the past, and now I would consider Democracy Now! To be an enemy. I wouldn't approach them as of the anti-war movement that's gone astray. I consider Amy Goodman to be completely on the other side. She pushed the Syria dirty war. She pushed the white helmet PSYOP. She pushed every step of the way. She pushed Russiagate. She hosted freaking Kurt Eichenwald 4 times.
Well, not twice, but
4 times. The biggest fraud of Russiagate. She sandbagged Julian Assange. She's now pushing the Ukraine proxy war narrative. She pushed the Uyghur genocide narrative to gin up a new Cold War with China. It's nonstop on Democracy Now. It's not the exception to the rulers. It's an accessory to the ruling class. And there needs to be a substantial challenge.
There you have it. Boy, oh boy. I'll post this as a link on Facebook. It probably will make a lot of Kansas progressives cross-eyed, and Kansas conservatives will probably love it because they love hearing, they love hearing about the quote-unquote left fight among itself, but they don't like recognizing the latest louder with chowder Daily Wire rift going on over which billionaire to suck up to when you get funding for these shows. So we're going to go on and see if we get to, that's what it's all about. Millionaires and billionaires investing, that's the word, investing into these new shows. And the Gray Zone is not one of those at all. And I'm happy to report. We'll see if we can get it. The Gray Zone is going to be appearing weekly at WBAI, which is the same place where, ironically, Law and Disorder, which we carry on Thursdays, Law and Disorder Radio comes from, WBAI Radio in New York City. We'll see what happens. We'll see what we can do. Uh-oh. It's crime time with John Graham. we did it. We had to, sorry, we had to play a little canned crime jazz for you. But we've got John on the horn. We learned a little bit, I think, from the Bronx. I guess when the Bronx, New York calls Philadelphia, you got to let it ring a couple times, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. Strange wires overlap or something. Your message goes
probably
from Kansas probably to the Bronx and then somehow to me. I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, no. It's not Kansas. Don't blame Kansas gets blamed for everything. I mean, Mike Pompeo,
well,
Sam
Brown. No, I wasn't blaming Kansas. I was just saying Kansas is the source of the phone call, which ricochets through Bronx to Philadelphia
right.
area here.
I think it hits the Bronx and they just like, who the fuck is calling us from Kansas?
Right. Well, your first three calls, I ended up talking to myself. I was going like, wait a minute. And then I hear, wait a minute.
The Bronx hooked me up. Like, I could see you answer the phone. I don't know.
Yeah,
okay,
well, for some reason it switched me to talk to myself, and I wasn't talking to you. But here we are. Hey, we're hooked up. Yeah,
you were in, and the listeners got, like I said, a good 5 minutes of canned crime jazz. So, and we've got a real twist today, listeners, because it's pretty neat actually. The New Yorker. John Grant set me up with the New Yorker. The January 23rd issue of the New Yorker has this. Last week we talked about Critic at Large, a column in it. This week, John and I are going to talk about a letter from South Carolina, and it's by James Lasdin, L-A-S-D-U-N, Lasdin.
Lasdin is a novel. He's written like five or six novels. I have a short sort of crime noir novel that he's written. So, you know, he's really sort of steeped in this crime mindset. And so he's really, I mean, it's an excellent piece.
Is he from South Carolina, you think?
I don't think so, but I don't know, you know. No, he's...
Would you say he's a Southern writer?
No, not necessarily. I actually don't know where he's from, but I don't ever see him as the Southern writer in that sense. No, he's a popular writer. He's written some nonfiction as well. So he's a really fine writer. Anyway, we know that. Yeah.
Well, I'll let you riff here in a minute, but I want to get my sights right. For the New Yorker, it's a letter from South Carolina, the headline title is The Swamp. Which immediately caught my eye, and the illustration shows this blonde guy in a handcuff, money floating down over, looks like a plantation and two dead bodies.
Right.
I mean, the graphic in the headline, I thought, is this about Trump? The swamp, you know?
it's certainly about big corruption and regional corruption, and I guess you can't associate Trump without Manhattan, you know. Brooklyn into Manhattan is a big major con man.
I immediately began reading it, and it's a long piece, listeners. It's not short, but it's good. And if you're a true crime person, I get in and out of it. I have to stop maybe because I get addicted to it.
We love crime and murder and all that stuff. We love it.
Yeah, you can actually see the court TV on your mainstream television is covering this trial. Jury selection started Monday. So you listeners of Radio Free Kansas, this is a real hookup. You can watch this high class in the low country.
Oh, yeah.
Now, John Grant is. let me finish your introduction.
My bad. Go ahead.
It's high class in the low, what is called the low country, and John is going to talk about his experiences in South Carolina.
Oh.
I don't know anything about this.
My younger brother lives in Charleston, and he's unlike me, I'm the sort of the leftist in the family and the middle child, the lost middle child, that's me. Well, my younger brother is a total devotee of the ethos of the Grant family and all that, and he was in the Army, was a captain, administered the multi-service brig in Charleston. That's why he moved to Charleston. So I visited down there. I'm aware of South Carolina. It's a beautiful place. Charleston has lots of water. It's called the Low Country all around there because it's close to sea level, and as is Charleston. There must be 15 bridges in the city. This is a little, off towards the coast a bit. I have to look at a map, see exactly where it is. But the area, as I say, this is a regional crime story. Con men, crimes, murder, all this stuff, stealing money and whatnot. In a very out-of-the-way area near the big city there, town would be Buford. And think the movie Forrest Gump, which was shot in this area, this low country area where there a lot of shrimp boats and things like that, which, was a factor in the plot of Forrest Gump. Anyway, that'll give you an image of where this place is. Well, it had an industrial history. This guy, James Lassen, goes into all the history of this place, which is so instrumental in the nature of this crime. And so this family, the Murdoch family, spelled M-U-R-D, what is it here? M-U-R-D-A-U-G-H, go way back to Alex Murdoch, the guy now on trial, to his great-great-grandfather. And they have had a lock on the solicitor's office, or like the prosecutor's office and whatnot, in the legal system in this out-of-the-way sort of South Carolina hamlet or whatever you want to call it. So over the years, as industrialization has kind of pulled away and left the place without a lot of industry and things, the legal system run by the Murdochs, under this fellow Alex, turned into a predatory sort of operation in which he would fraudulently, get death sue for certain person's death, and he would not tell the family he was doing that, and he would just pocket all their money and things like that. I mean, blatant stuff. Well, plot is much, much more torrid than even that. Someone in the news yesterday when the trial started reported it as far as this region goes, again, where my brother lives, again, this region goes, this is the trial of the century. This is the O.J. Simpson trial for this Southern Hamlet corruption deal. This guy is accused, Alex Murdoch, of murdering his wife and his son, Paul. The story starts out with Paul, who's the prince of this powerful family, drunk, driving a boat with all his friends, and he runs into a bridge and kills one of the girls on the boat. This starts a whole chain of events. Where he's trying to protect his son, who, of course, he ends up charged murdering in the end. But this stuff cascaded and revealed so many other kind of crimes and financial situations of, harvesting the community almost legally to make money in a predatory fashion, that, the lid has been blown off this operation. It's been tucked back in the tributaries and the swamps and all the shrimp boat areas and things like that. So it's you know, a fascinating story that's only going to, you know, go on and on. And they're trying to pick a jury now. And how do you pick a jury when, of course, everybody knows who the Murdochs are and they know the story? And so it's just one of those amazing, you know, trials in American history that just, you know, reveal so much more than just the murder. And again, it's just beginning. Trust me, there's going to be movies of this. It's a natural, you know, and we have not heard the end of it. And, of course, we don't know where it's going. We don't know if the guy will be convicted. Of course, he's innocent until proven guilty. But it's that. And then, of course, the story of the, the killer out in California who, attacked a dance hall during, the Asian New Year's. And I know from my trip to Vietnam, you know, the Asian New Year Tet is a really, really big deal. It's like Christmas times six, you know. It's culturally, for Asians, the thing. You know, they go around, they buy kumquat bushes, and I filmed them in Saigon doing that. It's just... and to say Happy New Year to someone, certainly in Vietnam, it's Chúc Mừng Năm Mới. Chúc Mừng Năm Mới. That's like Merry Christmas or Happy New Year, you know. And so this event where people go to dance and enjoy themselves is just shot up by the 72-year-old Asian, and then he is disarmed by this young fellow at another dance hall. It's just, I mean, these two stories are in the paper today, and it just goes like, whoa, a lot of interesting stuff, terrible stuff.
Yeah.
It's it's happening.
I just want to go back to the Murdoch.
Sure.
Think for a little bit, because it's such an incredible article. Lasden, I don't know how to pronounce his name. The writer.
Mm-hmm.
He
sounds good.
This
thing
about the drunken boat.
Yeah.
Crashing, and the young 19-year-old girl
right.
who died seems to be so like, I don't know the right word, flotsam. It's just like her death is like. It begins the story, and it's just she's just one
right.
of the many dead people
right.
around this family.
Exactly.
And her name, ironically, her name was Mallory Beach. That is,
right.
I found that extremely. Mallory Beach was her name, and she after the wreck, and Paul, the son, who was later murdered by allegedly
right.
his father. Her body shows up a week later in a marsh, and I think out here when I read this story, it describes something
right.
very interesting. It's I don't know where this exactly took place. I'll have to read it again and again, because where is this place they're talking about in relation to South Carolina? Because it reminds me a lot, the way he writes it, it reminds me a lot of rural Kansas without the water. You know what I mean?
Instead of swamp, you have open spaces.
yeah. Well, it's a big family. It's a big family. They have a big, they own a lot of land. And they're part of the local legal system.
They got a lock on it. They control it. Yeah. They're using it as a predatory tool, it's like the legal system. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me after the Michael, what's his name, the guy that was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. What's his name, Michael, I forget, my brain fart here. Anyway, he, what that situation, a cop killing, revealed blew the lid on, if you will, in the same way this is blowing the lid on this predatory sort of situation, cultural situation, a corrupt swamp, if you will, is that in Ferguson, there was a definitely a predatory system that exploited, especially poor blacks, and got them ensnared them so much with court costs and cascading cases. You didn't pay your ticket, your parking ticket within 5 days. You know, they double it, they triple it. You know, before you know it, and this has happened to me in Philadelphia, before you know it, you know, you're a scofflaw. You're a total scofflaw. And they hate scofflaws. So the point is that the system is a predatory system that has allowed to, because the legal systems are locked up with these family traditions and the powers and all that, that you find these places, and you find them a lot in the South. You know, they used to joke about the speed traps, you know, the speed traps in the South where, you know, they'd have Corporal Barney Fife out there as, some Yankee Pennsylvania car is flying through town 20 miles over the limit. And, you know, they'll stop you. And back in the 50s, you know, they used to really, extortion cases, fleecing people as they go through. So this is a case of a swamp. He calls it the swamp. Things got so desperate for these people in their predatory activities, especially this man Alex, the patriarch of this whole current family, got so hung out to dry and was so greedy and so predatory that, you know, once his son, you know, turns out to have killed somebody in this boat accident, and he's trying to protect them in the legal system, it just then explodes. One thing leads to another, and before you know it, the whole pathological, corrupt system in this little swampy town is revealed, and there's no way out, you know. And so he's so desperate that things are, you know, his wife and son may have balked and said, "No, Dad, no, we're not going to go along with it." Well, he kills them, allegedly. Incredible story. I mean, this is like right out of Shakespeare, you know? I mean, Shakespeare wrote murder stories better than anybody, you know? The idea of power, that was the issue here, you know? You haven't heard the last of this story, you know?
No. One of the key thing it swings on is that the area, it's Hampton County, by the way. Hampton, H-A-M-P-T-O-N, Hampton County in South Carolina, where this power comes out of, where this, and there was they made a law where it was possible anybody could file these major lawsuits, and there's always a lawyer. Now, I happen to have worked for a bunch of lawyers when I was a private detective, and a lot of these lawsuits were poor people suing their, like, a mortgage company, or because the neighbor had a crazy dog that rips off half the neighbor's daughter's face, and they were outrageous medical fees, and so you would sue the mortgage company to get the money. The lawyers knew where the money was at, the deep pockets, as they call them. Rather than sue the neighbor personally, they sued the mortgage company that the neighbors were indebted to. And there's all these, and this is one of many games that they're called tort, T-O-R-T lawyers, plaintiff's lawyers. In South Carolina, they had Hampton County had a unique situation where an injury could have, I'm quoting from the article, injury could have occurred anywhere in South Carolina, and you could sue in whatever, they could sue in whatever county they chose. So what happened, now this law was changed in 2005, but it had been there for generations, generations.
Right,
and all these wars.
A hell of a lot of statutory damage in those decades that it was in law. Yeah.
Right. And, well, Sam, the generationally, evidently the first and second, Randolph Murdoch and all the whole Murdoch clan, they were all warriors. They all made
right.
They made a huge empire locally. And they said that
right.
it'd become a mecca for plaintiffs with obliging juries. Now, this is interesting because it brought your drawing juries from the local Hampton County with obliging juries frequently awarding multi-million-dollar verdicts in suits brought by PMPED, which is it could be pimped or pumped, whatever you want to call it, PMPED, which was a law firm that
pimp.
Was ran and managed by Alex Murdoch's father, who was also, I guess, attorney general. I don't think they call them attorney generals, but of the state. And
they were called solicitors,
I
think.
Yeah. So and the article further goes on that this PMPED pump had been doing and most of its business with a Hampton County-based Palmetto State Bank. So it's almost like they enable the lower people, for lack of better, we're talking low country. The lower people are enabled in juries, and they themselves get involved in suing. They make some money. They make some money from it. And when you get reading this article, the more you dig through it, you find out that even they were making some money, but it was chump change, in my words, chump change, compared to what their lawyers were making on top. This generations of lawyers that were on top of the county, Hampton County.
Well, they were suing for people without even telling the people they were suing for them, and then they were just absconding with the award money.
And when they find out,
you know, you
could
see
out,
as you. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and when you find out that they were suing and getting money,
mm-hmm.
they would threaten to whistleblow, and they say, "Well, here's $25,000. Now shut up."
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And that's
what
they literally do.
Exactly.
They pay off the.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. In other words, they give $25,000 where the whole lawsuit was $190,000. You know, so they
right,
get
or a million or even a million. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But described it a little bit. What was so amazing is that the legal system in South Carolina, I think this is involved in state legislatures. Thing is that through pressure and lobbying and power and all this kind of stuff, that they got a law put on that if you were suing a corporation or whatever for a torts, as you were talking, you could sue them in any county in the state where they have some sort of operation, right? And the point then became that this county, I think it was, like you said, Hampton or something like that, this county had got its, you know what, together, and they all put their heads together, and they then worked out the criminal justice system in a corrupt manner that, you know, it was rewarding for people in a corrupt manner to take their suit and open it in Hampton County because they knew the setup, they'd get a big award. And, it was all, again, a corrupt setup to channel all these cases into this county so that they could be, concluded corruptly and, line the pockets of a lot of people, the Murdochs especially. And it's like, the absolute depravity of it, is – a ruthless depravity of it is just sort of, you stand in awe, they did this for generations, and it all, I think what's happening here is I've mentioned this before, that we are in what I would call, many others call, the third Reconstruction. First one being after the Civil War, and there was a backlash at the KKK, which stopped it, you know, from going too far. Then there was the civil rights movement in the 60s, which, of course, had its own backlashes and, you know, was finally turned, you know, stopped, I guess, with the election of Ronald Reagan and that cycle. And then now we have a third one. So what does that mean? That means a lot of exposing kind of information is just churning out as the backlash comes in with the Trumpian insurrection, et cetera, blah, 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 you know, the thugs and whatnot. DeSantis, you know, censoring any information in Florida about a history of racial abuse and whatnot. So, you know, the backlash then, you know, eggs on the effort to reveal all these terrible, disgusting things that, you know, nobody wants to know. Like, my brother would never tell me about this in South Carolina because this is a shameful thing, you know. This guy, in other words, the problem with this guy is he got caught. You know, he went too far. And he was caught, and in being caught in a mood in the nation that it wants reconstruction, it wants to hear about these abuses in the past, you know, it's out of the bag. There's nothing they can do about it. The you know, the crime shows all over America are going to be tooting this thing like you wouldn't believe, and you know, we're off to the races. And of course, then there'll be a backlash. You got, you know, South Carolina high society, you know, which my brother is not part of, but I would imagine aspires to. I've been to his house and, you know, and, you know, it's a culture there. It's a deeply embedded culture that is, of course, connected to white supremacy. It's connected to lynchings. It's connected to people getting away with murder for racial crimes. In the history of the South, you know, of course, they had that famous, you know, this young 17-year-old shallow child walked into a black church in Charleston and, you know, listened to him a while and then killed like six people. You know, and, my brother
too?
Trying
is
to
that there?
Remember that was
that
in
was
Charleston. That was in
South
Charleston,
Carolina.
The city, yeah, big city, yeah. Beautiful city. Charleston is just a beautiful city. And they go out of their way to make it, you know, classic Old South and, you know, and that sort of thing, and which, again, my dear brother does love. I mean, he loves that sort of milieu, that culture, that great sort of, you know, Gone with the Wind Tara culture or something, that, you know, South Carolina is famous or notorious for. And unfortunately for that gang, for that element, this has basically blown the lid on, you know, as they say, the swamp in near Charleston. I have to look at a map to get it better located.
Captain County.
And I've driven through there. Again, it's just a beautiful area. A lot of water. A lot of water.
This guy doesn't write like it's a beautiful area. He writes, Lanson wrote this article. There are beautiful areas, he acknowledges, but he talks about the outlying rural areas as mainly a lot of trailers.
Well,
and,
you
know, you call it the low country. I thought it was interesting,
right.
And it's a mix. You said the bag is open nowadays. It's, when it comes to corruption. Well, here's an interesting fact out of this article. A guy named his lead attorney, Alex Murdoch, lead attorney, is a guy, and you'll see him on TV on Court News, listeners. Vic Harpootlian. Now, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's Harpootlian.
I think he's a state legislator, too, yeah.
Well, he's the former chair of the state Democratic Party. Right. And his wife was recently made U.S. ambassador to, of all places, Slovenia, where Mrs. Trump comes from Slovenia. So
there you go.
Harputlian has bragged about playing golf with President Joe Biden and his wife, playing golf with Joe, and his wife was recently made the U.S. ambassador. And there's another on the other side. The attorney general is a guy named Alan Wilson, who is, of course, a Republican, and he is a naked, open Trumpster who's been anti-vaccination, the whole thing, no mask, you know. That's the guy who's taking over the case of prosecuting Alex Murdoch, the attorney general, a Trumpster Republican, against the former chair of the state Democratic Party, that attorney, and a friend of or golf playing guy with President Joe, whose wife is now an ambassador. I mean, there's a lot of dirt in this. There's layers and layers of it's a mixed grab of
talk about
dirt.
At this secrecy case that Biden has sort of put his foot in his mouth again, sort of metaphorically, where he's, you know, all these secret documents here and there. You know, he's pretty much taken some of the gas out of the bag for prosecuting Trump on illegal stuff. So, you know, as we know, I mean, I've written about Joe Biden before. You know, Joe Biden, you know, is a very capable politician. I'm not saying he's a crook necessarily, but boy, he certainly knows what he's doing when he exploits his power. I experienced that personally one time when I asked him a question, and he just ran across the room like he was going to slug me. And he just ate me alive because I asked a question about harm reduction programs in the drug war, you know, and he was pushing the drug war. I mean, he was the chief proponent for the drug wars. And the last thing he wanted was some smacked ass like me asking a question about harm reduction. So, boy, it was like Joe ate me alive. I'll never forget it. But anyway, you know, so, yeah, he has a lot of stuff in his past. You know, they're going to go for Hunter, and you know they're going to find some really stuff, you know.
Yeah, I think it was an understatement today when you said that the bag is now open, because it's a very big bag of corruption. It's all corruption. To me, it's all corruption among the elite, the big guys. Even
exactly,
down
it
the,
is.
The county level.
That famous bank robber said, why do you rob banks? He says, that's where the money is. So, you know, the rich people have the money. It's all going up to the rich people. So now we're surprised that the rich people are fighting amongst themselves for it, you know. This is the way history goes in this country, you know. The money goes up. And here we are, you know. And the corruption is just out of hand. It's out of control. You don't get anywhere in America without cheating. That's my thesis. And the problem is, if you're caught, it's you got caught. That's the problem. It's not that you cheated. It's not that you, you know, cut corners or went, you know, did this or did that, you know. It's so that this leaves the legal system in America and American citizens open to, you know, the randomness of selective enforcement. You know, if everybody's doing it, if everybody's corrupt, you know, you can always find something on somebody. You know, that's how they got Al Capone.
Well,
they got him for income tax evasion. You know, you know,
well,
it's selective enforcement. It's a real tool. You know,
I think it's a uniquely American thing. It's with this thing of the so-called American dream. Everybody can be rich or president of the United States.
Yep.
And your race
and
mentality. And then what everybody can do is they can get an AR-15 and they can damage their brains thinking they're going to get a free ticket if they go to the latest war, pick your war.
Right.
And but for the people at the bottom, I think that's the real choice, you know, or you end up settling for peanuts in a lawsuit that some shyster attorney is going to get you a big money, and then he takes most of it. But it's amazing in this article because it's like it really reveals these generations. For instance, the courtroom on court TV, listeners, if you watch this, the Murdoch thing, they're only in jury selection. It'll be they estimate. I think I read they had to call in like 900 jurors, and they're bringing them in waves because there's so many corrupt. Again, there's so many regular Joe citizens that are probably connected to these families. And
they're frightened of these people or beholden to these people. You know,
And what do you expect?
And so you get to this dilemma in the courts of juries. In a case like this, is if a person, it's not surprising that a person would know something and significant stuff about the Murdochs because they're so prominent. So the only people you're going to get in a jury who've never heard of the Murdochs are people who have their heads up their you know what, you know, and they're not maybe the brightest or most attentive people. So you want them on your jury, you know? It's like,
But there's one last thing about this article, and then we can talk about mass crime, I guess. This other point for court for our listeners who watch court TV or are stuck on true crime on YouTube or on podcasts.
It's everywhere.
So when you if you're watching it on court TV, if and when they get out of jury. There's another little sentence in this article, again, from The Swamp in the latest New Yorker, January 23rd. It says the courtroom, the people at the court, a portrait of Alec Murdoch's grandfather, Randolph
great-grandfather, you know, one of the gray eminences from his family past. They had to take the photograph, the print down.
The picture.
In the courtroom.
The back
of the picture, painting or photo, whatever it was. Because, you know, the heir of this person is on trial for murder. So they, you know, would definitely, you know, have some influence on the jury if they're looking at his great-grandfather up there on the wall while they're deciding whether to hang him.
Behind the judge. Yeah, behind the judge's feet, where the judge is sitting. But here's the last dirt. Randolph Buster Murdoch Jr. That's the guy who had his picture taken down in the courtroom. Buster was a notorious. It says Buster was a notorious reprobate who was linked to an illicit liquor ring. He was linked to the liquor ring. His father, Randolph Senior Murdoch. Died in what some suspect was a suicide made to look like an accident staged with the intent of enriching his heirs. Nobody knows what caused his car to stall on railway tracks and get hit by a train one night. I mean,
Well, that's the thing. You get one thing, and then there was Satterfield, I think, was his housekeeper. Well, somehow she met a bad end on his property, right? I don't know. She fell down the stairs or some god-awful thing. They're exhuming her body and reopening the case. But anyway, she was killed, quote, accidentally. And he then filed a huge lawsuit with, you know, her children to benefit. Well, he didn't tell the children. He just filed it. He won it, and he took all the money. It's like, wow, that takes some brass, boy. That really takes some brass to pull stuff like that off. And that's the kind of people that gravitate to the top in this sort of moral low country sort of world. You know, eventually, you know, some of them do get caught. Like in this case, this guy's done, but. God, what? It's taken like four generations for it to be revealed, you know. Where is this happening, and it hasn't been revealed yet, you know what I mean? It hasn't reached the critical mass to get in the mainstream, you know. The only people who know about it are the winners who are, you know, predating on everybody, and the people who are being screwed, they know about it, but it doesn't get up to the mainstream, you know, journalism, you know, which is my profession.
Well,
you know, things don't reach there until they get so bad that it explodes and there's sewage everywhere from the explosion. You know?
Yeah, well, you know, it happens. I can say some in Kansas, if you will, but in Pennsylvania, what do you hear?
Yeah.
It's like the mainstream media is covering this, but listen, I got to tell you, the New Yorker did a much better job at digging into explaining this. James Lasden.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Lasden.
Well, I've run into New Yorker reporters in El Salvador. I remember one guy I met, ran into him several times in El Salvador. You know, and this guy, it wasn't a drop-in sort of thing. You know, I drop in and do a runaway story and go back and, you know, sensationalize and do this story. No, this guy lived there for months, you know what I mean? And so this guy has done the same thing. He spent a lot of time, and this is a writer's sort of account of his experiences, you know, digging around in this area. So that's why you get a long story. You know, today I had a story in the New York Times, a newspaper, a very good story wrapping this up. Again, the story's broke officially in the mainstream now because the trial has opened. You know, and so the trial is going to go on maybe a couple of months. And so that'll give time for all the murder and mayhem shows, you know, the thousands of them throughout our entertainment system to get their version of it, get pieces of it and slather it around and pass some bad information around in the process. You know how this thing works. And, and, of course, you wonder, my question is, what is fine, upstanding, post-Civil War South Carolina low country society, how are they going to respond to this with all this
trash?
I
want to give you my answer. Kansas answer.
Yeah, go ahead.
I see it around here. They're going to, you know, it's they're going to profess, if it's in the newspapers, it's people, what you see in the newspaper and what people say about what they read in the newspaper is ignorance.
Right.
It's stupidity disguised as ignorance.
Right.
as ignorance. You will
Fair
hear
enough.
Nothing
I like it.
From your
yeah.
brother. You will hear nothing from the rich ranchers.
No, I know
the people
I won't
involved
hear.
In a good example is this. Just count, listeners, count how many times you Fox News, and I know almost all you guys, people out here, watch Fox News. How many times?
Well,
do you
I
hear
watch
daily,
it too.
Yeah. How much do you hear about another rich guy, super billionaire, Rupert Murdoch, and getting slapped around in the lawsuit about the elections? I mean, and the election machine, Dominion election machine. Manufacturer,
right?
That's
right.
A multi-billion law.
Well, he is financially liable to that. That story's been going around. That malicious story's been going around for like 10 years at least. And I remember it first started because Hugo Chavez, you know, the commie they love to hate. Because Hugo Chavez, one of his better decisions was in the election, he hired this company to do voting machines in Venezuela,
right.
And they were wonderful. They worked perfectly. You know, they were not corrupt. It was actually successful, and that was proven. But still, it didn't, because everybody hated Hugo Chavez. You know, they made the story their own. They made it into a lie, and it continued in the right wing, you know, fever sphere or whatever. And you know, by the time then that Rudy Giuliani grabbed onto it, and, you know, oh, Hugo Chavez, commies, you know, with voting boxes and all this. And it was like, what, you know? The point is, Hugo Chavez was actually using its integrity, you know, there was no corruption that no one has been able to find any, you know, and they were very efficient machines. And so it was the, I guess, a case of the, quote, big lie, you know. It's like, you know, you say, no, it's not dark outside. It's really the sun is up. It may be 3 a.m., but, hey, it's up. This, believe me, the sun is up, you know. And if you say it long enough, you know, dunderheads around the world who want to believe it are going to start believing it, you know.
But I'm just saying, the conservative news media, the legacy media, the big media, they, I mean, they have a tendency to, like, here's an example. Court News, which is really sort of the Fox News of true crime, if you ask me. Court TV, has a tendency to sensationalize first, and I've watched very carefully. Nothing covered in the New Yorker article. Well, not, I won't say that. Mm-hmm. But Alex Murdoch's head attorney playing golf with Joe Biden, the head attorney's wife becoming the ambassador of Slovenia, and the attorney general is a crazy Trumpster. I mean, you don't get that. You don't get that at Court TV. They don't get into they barely mention the what I call collateral damage of the.
Well, they
rich,
they play up the sensationalism, I imagine, for ratings and whatnot. You know, you seem to
they
be
don't
suggesting
carry, they don't. They don't go. Yeah. They don't get into the intergenerational, like the son Paul considered a murder. They didn't ever. I haven't heard about Mallory Beach. The 19-year-old girl who was killed in the boating accident.
Well, Court TV keeps the story in the courts. This James Lazen, who's a novelist, took the story out of the courts into the community, into the region, and showed what a pathology in this region going back for generations and generations, leading back to goddamn slavery. Come on, let's be real here. Crow and all that. Again, this has been going on generation.
Uh-huh. Big conservative media, including like Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire, two weeks ago sensationalized the mass murder of a Latinx family in the barrio of outer Los Angeles, okay? And they claimed it was a cartel execution. They made that big news. It was everywhere on YouTube, everywhere. Then you have these two mass killings, I guess three actually, two in quick succession in California. And now they're sensationalizing, they're talking about California, you know, and they reject anything about gun control. Of course, they don't. When people in California,
it's the same old story, right? Well, you brought it up. Let me say something. I'm prepared to say on this.
Go ahead.
This 72-year-old Asian gunman who killed 11 people with a Mac-10, and I remember the Mac-10 in the movie The Counselor. It's one of those pistol things, and it where an AK-47 shoots like that, this shoots like that, you know, and a 9mm, you know, in like 3 seconds, you know, you get about 15 rounds. And so this is a very, very wicked weapon, you know. Anyway, and of course, the hero disarms him in the second place and saves, no doubt, a lot of people. But this case especially, it's a theme of mine that I have been aware of since reading a book by Chris Hedges called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And he wrote that in after he came back from Bosnia and El Salvador, 2002. Great, great book. Chris Hedges' best book. And the last chapter is on Eros and Thanatos, which, of course, I've mentioned maybe, is they come from writings by Sigmund Freud between the world wars when he was in discussion with Einstein trying to figure out why the world was going to hell in a handbasket and it was probably going to have another world war. And they obviously couldn't figure it out because it happened. Well, here's, and so think of this gunman who's got murder on his mind, goes to, it's New Year's, it's Asian New Year's. And again, I've been in Saigon when this is a big, big holiday, Chuk Mong Nam Moi. You know, this is everybody, Asians all love it. And they're at a dance place where these people, older people, are having a joyous time dancing, learning Latin dances, etc. And it's just a wonderful kind of human and sort of situation. And that is, again, fits into this classic idea, Freudian idea of instinctually a place of eros versus the instinctual death instinct, or he calls thanatos, which is, and here's how Hedges describes Freud's ideas. Sigmund Freud divided the forces in human nature between the eros instinct, the impulse within us that propels us to become close to others, to preserve and conserve, and the thanatos, or death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For Freud, these forces were in eternal conflict. He was pessimistic about ever eradicating war. All human history, he argued, is a tug of war between these two instincts. Well, this gunman story fits right, you know. And as I've, you know, written about, this idea of thanatos, the death instinct, wars and bombings and killings and torture and all this kind of stuff, always trumps eros, always trumps the, you know, sort of human connections and, you know, that you find in a dance studio where people would go to have an innocent good time and be with people. And, of course, in eros, the whole idea of erotic is the roots of the term erotic and sexuality and all that is certainly part of this. This is how people connect in eros, in sex. But people also, in the death instinct side, sex is also a big item over there, you know, rape and sexual tortures and all these kind of horrific things that, you know, we see every night on our cultural channels. So these forces, you know, are really at play. They're, you know, as Chris Hedges pointed out, a book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, after experiencing war in El Salvador and in Bosnia, you know. And so he wrote this, and how important that was. You know, when you read Freud on it, it's a little half-baked. You know, it's Freud, you know, comes out of his interests about projecting his own peccadilloes about sexuality and his mother and God knows what, you know, and he's a great writer, and he you know, but he got over that stuff, you know, and he was trying to figure out why people kill each other. And, you know, he never came to really a good answer about it. He just sort of raised the question. And again, Chris Hedges explains it really, really well. So it's a book I recommend, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning by Chris Hedges. But, it, you know, he's on to something when you think of these crazy, crazy shootings. You know, what, you know, they're saying, what is this man's motive? Well, Chris Hedges knows what his motive is. His motive is he's unhappy, and he thinks the solution is just chaos and violence, and in the end, his own self-destruction. And that he plays that out, and he shoots himself in the van. And meanwhile, the people who have just been trying to enjoy each other and to engage with each other and to meet with each other, to dance with each other, laugh and sing, it's all those kinds of things in the world of Eros, that's all been squashed and shut down and set back and traumatized by this Thanatos death instinct. So on that charming note,
we gotta go.
All right,
John
Mike.
Grant.
Good show. Bye-bye.